The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Dean Goss tried everything to solidify his place in Houston's entertainment world, and for a while it worked. Even after he and his wife Elaine lost their once wildly popular establishment, the Dean Goss Dinner Theater, Dean attempted to stay in the game. But other than three bit parts in a few Hollywood movies, the man couldn't catch a break. Not even the screenplays he wrote caught on, and when he tried his hand at politics, that too failed. But things got exponentially worse than that. After the March 1982 murder of Elaine, Dean was floundering, struggling both emotionally and financially. He borrowed $4,000 cash from local carpet and flooring giant Frank Joseph DeMaria to pay for his wife's funeral, but he couldn't pay it back. That might have, perhaps, proved to be a deadly mistake. Just 14 years before, DeMaria was implicated in the murder for hire of Alan Harry Berg, a man who co-owned Imperial Carpet, DeMaria's direct competitor. But, hot off his win, defending Candy Mosler and her nephew-lover Melvin Lane Powers, legendary criminal defense attorney Percy Foreman defended the man DeMaria was said to have hired to kill Allen, infamous hitman Charles Void Harrelson. Foreman got Harrelson off, and Frank DeMaria was in the clear as a result. It was never proven that the carpet magnate had anything to do with Allen Berg's death, it must be noted. And the long-standing beef between DeMaria and the Bergs might have been why the man was implicated in the first place. Anyway, 47-year-old Dean Goss was flat broke and going nowhere when he met a 39-year-old woman named Paula Malone, an incredibly successful real estate agency owner and mother of two. Paula and Dean fell in love, and mere months after they began their whirlwind romance, they were married. That same month, the Cattleman's Cove Restaurant and Club opened up, Dean Goss's newest venture, which was made possible by a $150,000 investment by his new bride Paula. Just when everything was looking up, tragedy once again touched the life of the former Jackie Gleason of Houston, first in the form of a suspicious vandalization, then, just as it had come in 1982, in the form of murder. Just 2 months after the Dean Goss family's Cattleman's Cove opened, it was badly vandalized inside. In June of 1984, an unknown vandal threw gallons of paint on the walls of the establishment, smashed countless dishes, slashed and shredded the upholstery of the seating, and destroyed Paula Goss's prized piano. Nothing, however, was stolen. Instead of using the entirety of the $45,000 insurance payout to make the necessary repairs to Cattleman's Cove, and presumably instead of paying Frank DeMaria back, who he owed $4,000 to, Dean Goss pocketed much of the settlement. City health and building inspectors were less than impressed with Dean's half-ass attempts at passing off the remodeling. After citing many code violations, inspectors refused to let the Cattleman's Cove Restaurant and Club reopen. But things were about to get way worse than that. In early July 1984, James Jackson Brown, or JJ as he was known, disappeared. The 44-year-old man was maitre d' at the Cattleman's Cove. For 3 days, his wife was worried sick. On Friday, July 6th, when a cleaning lady who was employed at a motel near the Houston Astrodome reported the putrid stench of death seeming to originate from a particular car in the parking lot there, it was discovered that the vehicle belonged to JJ. Houston police drove to the man's house, retrieved a set of keys from the man's spouse, returned to JJ's car, and opened the trunk. Inside was the decomposing body of J.J. Brown, his decomposition expedited by the humid, sweltering Houston summer days. The man was riddled with bullets. The cops discovered J.J.'s wallet was missing and theorized that robbery was the motive, but they also couldn't help but feel strongly that the vandalism at the restaurant and club the previous month was somehow connected to this murder. Dean Goss, however, gave the Houston police a report that only muddied the waters of J.J.'s slaying. He told detectives that J.J. had been aggressively flirting with a female server at the Cattleman's Cove, and that the woman's boyfriend threatened physical violence against the maitre d' if he didn't back off his old lady. The murder of James Jackson Brown remains unsolved at the time of this recording, in July of 2021. It's not the last unsolved slaying in this story. 6 months into their marriage, Paula Goss was regretting the day she agreed to marry Dean, let alone the day she gave the man $150,000 to open up the Cattleman's Cove. Since he had half-assed the repairs to the restaurant and club, and pocketed a good chunk of the insurance settlement for himself after it was vandalized, the entire venture went under. The place only existed for a couple months. Dean Goss's time hobnobbing with Houston's rich and famous was pretty much over, and he had taken down his second wife with him. Paula's $150,000 was gone. She took on a second job in October 1984 at a labor service company, in addition to her work at the Harris County Appraisal District. Paula was attempting to keep the family afloat financially. When they tied the knot, she'd moved in with Dean and his three boys in his home in the Meyerland neighborhood of Houston. Since Dean Goss couldn't keep a job to save his life, Paula was the Goss family's lone support. But Paula could not do it. With Dean and the boys, there were just too many bills and expenses. She expressed as much to her boss at the labor service. She was desperate, Paula told him, and she didn't know what to do. As if the woman wasn't going through enough with Dean's bullshit, things got substantially worse. Around the time she picked up the second job, Paula Goss began receiving repeated phone calls. The threatening calls came from an unknown caller, Paula told friends and family. This caller knew intimate details of the woman's personal life, and they went on for months, well into 1985.
You won't know when, and you won't know where, but we're going to get you,
the caller would say, telling Paula she was going to end up like the first Mrs. Goss. The first Mrs. Goss, Elaine, of course, was killed by a gunshot wound to her head, fired at close range, in 1982, the murder unsolved. Needless to say, Paula Goss was terrified. Two burglaries at the Goss's Meyerland home in early 1985 only exacerbated her fear. In those crimes, Dean reported to have lost many personal items, though exactly what is unknown. Then came a shooting. On Sunday, February 24th, 1985, Dean Goss was rushed to the hospital after suffering a bullet wound to the chest. Not long after arriving at the hospital, Houston police detectives visited the man there. They were aware of the burglaries of his home and presumably also aware of the threatening phone calls that Paula Goss had been receiving. But, Dean told the cops, the shooting was an accident. While in the upstairs bathroom taking a bath, Dean told them, he thought he heard noises downstairs. He was paranoid because of the recent burglaries, so he grabbed his pistol and hurried down the staircase. When he got to the bottom, Dean said, he slipped and fell. The gun went off, and a bullet struck him in the chest. It's unclear if the police bought Dean's story. The circumstances are believable had this happened to anyone else in the world, but the incident seems suspicious when stacked atop the already complicated and convoluted circumstances that surround the life of Dean Neil Goss. Whatever the case, Dean was fine. The bullet was removed, and he was stitched up. However, the medical bills as the result of this supposed accidental shooting only added further financial strain and stress to the lives and marriage of Paula and Dean. Another unspeakably gruesome and tragic event was soon to follow. Before marrying, Dean's wife Paula was named Paula Jane Brawley. She was born on January 29, 1943, in Nashville, Tennessee, to Helen Dunlap and Paul Blackburn Brawley. Of the four children born to them, Paula was the oldest. Not long after starting their family, Helen and Paul Brawley settled down in Rock Hill, South Carolina, where Paul, an ex-aircraft engineer, started Brawley Coffee Service. In Rock Hill, Paula attended and graduated from Winthrop Training High School, and she went on to study chemistry at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. In 1964, Paula worked at Wachovia Bank and Trust in Greenville, South Carolina, where she married her first husband, becoming Paula Malone. A couple years later, the Malones moved to Houston, Texas, and had two boys, and Paula started the Paula Malone Real Estate Agency. She divorced in 1984, of course, and married Dean Goss. In May of 1985, Paula Goss traveled to South Carolina to see family. During her visit, Paula told her family that she intended to leave Dean. Though she wouldn't say exactly what, she told her family that she'd learned something about her husband, and she could not continue to be the man's wife. But Dean Goss had a surgery coming up to remove a benign sebaceous cyst from his lower left jaw, just under the ear. Paula told her family that she'd wait until after that surgery to leave him. When she got back to Houston, Paula broke her arm after taking a fall down the stairs at the Goss's Meyerland home. She told everyone it was her own clumsy fault and not the result of abuse or anything else suspicious. Paula phoned a friend in June of 1985 to ask if she could stay in the condominium they owned in southwest Houston while Dean was in New Orleans on business. Strange things were happening at the Goss home. Apparently, Paula had received calls from someone asking for Elaine, Dean's murdered first wife, and she'd found a garter of Elaine's in her and Dean's bed. Of course, Paula had also received all the calls threatening her life. By July, Paula's time was just about up with Dean, though not how she intended. She was over the marriage and certainly Dean's bullshit, and was spending days at a time in the homes of friends to avoid the man. Paula was going to leave him for good after his surgery, she told them. On Sunday, July 28, 1985, Dean was admitted into Methodist Hospital to await his surgery the following Wednesday. That day, July 31st, after the successful surgery to remove the cyst from Dean's jaw, Paula called the friends she'd been staying with from Dean's hospital room to tell them she was going to head back home and spend the night in her own bed. At 5 p.m., Paula left for the Goss's Meyerland home. At around 8 p.m., she chatted on the phone with her brother. Dean Goss Jr. and his friend Coy had spent the evening at a Houston comedy club. Just before midnight, the two arrived at the Goss home. They were shocked when they entered and found Paula Goss's bloodied body lying in the rear entryway of the house. Dean Jr. immediately called the police. When they arrived, the cops took note that there were no signs of forced entry. Nothing appeared to be missing, and the back door of the home was unlocked. A motive for the murder of 42-year-old Paula Brawley Goss was elusive. Later, at her autopsy, Harris County Medical Examiner Dr. Joseph Yahimchik cataloged Paula's injuries. Because of her body temperature, it was determined that the woman hadn't died long before Dean Jr. and his friend arrived to find her. Unlike Dean's first wife, Elaine, who was executed in that very house just 3 years prior, Paula's death was savage overkill. Like Elaine, who was shot once in the back of the head at close range, Dr. Yahimchik determined that Paula suffered a .25 caliber gunshot to the back of her neck at close range. The bullet traveled down as if Paula were kneeling or slouched over as the result of her many other injuries, almost all of which would have likely been fatal by themselves. Paula's throat was deeply slashed. She'd been stabbed repeatedly in the chest with a long knife, her ribcage riddled with stab wounds. There was a large cut on Paula's back, and three skull-crushing blunt force blows at the top of her head. Traces of tranquilizer and over-the-counter pain reliever were found in Paula Goss's blood, though likely this was due to the woman's broken arm, the injury sustained when she fell down the stairs, she said, the previous month. Paula's overkill murder was about as horrific as they come. Her husband, Dean Goss, was informed the following morning when he awoke while still at Methodist Hospital recovering from surgery. It's reported that he was in such a state of shock that he had to be sedated much more than he already was. Paula didn't get the grand send-off that Dean provided his first wife, Elaine. Though the Lewis and Sons funeral home provided a memorial service for Paula Goss, Dean had to pay in advance. His reputation of terrible credit and slow repayment for his first wife's funeral preceding the man. Paula's body was then sent to South Carolina at her family's expense to be buried at a family plot there. As the investigation into the murder of Paula Brawley Goss got underway, and since there was no clear motive as to why anyone would want the woman dead, Houston police detectives began collecting alibis of those closest to her. Dean Goss Sr., of course, was at Methodist Hospital downtown recovering from surgery, and besides being sedated and ordered to bed rest, countless doctors, nurses, and orderlies provided the man with an alibi that was as solid as they get. Even so, Dean refused to undergo a polygraph examination. Dean Jr., who along with his friend found his stepmother's bloodied, ravaged body, had been at the club called the Comedy Workshop. Several of his friends and the club's employees confirmed Dean Jr.'s alibi 100%. Dean's third-born son, 15-year-old Andy, was at his grandparents' house the entire time, his mother Elaine's parents. Then there was Dean's other boy, 22-year-old Craig. The cops were much less impressed with his alibi. When Craig's mother Elaine was murdered in March of 1982, he'd been in the house nearly the entire day while she lay dead in the upstairs study. Craig, who at this point was living in his own place in town, told detectives that on the night his stepmother Paula was slain, he had eaten dinner with two friends before returning home to his apartment and spending a quiet evening alone. Like his father, Craig refused to take a polygraph test. In fact, both he and Dean Sr.'s refusals to do so were described as belligerent in reports. Though in their defense, any attorney worth their weight in salt would have advised both men not to undergo polygraph examinations, whether they're guilty or not. Houston detectives were going nowhere fast, and the investigation stalled. But Craig Goss's alibi was said to be incredibly weak, and along with the fact that he was the only suspect ever named in the murder of his mother, he became the prime suspect, too, in Paula's murder. When the father of Dean Goss's first wife, Elaine, was asked if he thought the murder of his daughter and the murder of Paula Brawley Goss were connected, he replied,
"God, it sure looks that way."
Both he and Elaine's mother were shocked another of Dean's wives had been killed, and so brutally. Virginia and Henry Richmond said that Paula was a good stepmother to their grandchildren.
"I'm so weak, I can barely walk,"
Virginia said.
"I genuinely loved her."
Meanwhile, Dean Goss couldn't avoid Houston's television and newspaper reporters out for the scoop. He told them he didn't know who would kill either of his wives. There was no reason to hurt them, Dean said, And if it was something he'd done, a vendetta against him, why wouldn't the killer or killers just come and do him in? Dean told the press that he didn't know anything more than they did. He had no idea, he said, if the murder of Elaine and the slaying of Paula were linked. He and Paula were planning to get out of that house, Dean continued, and they'd started looking for a new place earlier in the year. It's unclear if Dean was being genuine here. Perhaps he didn't know Paula was planning to leave him. But anyway, the Houston police assigned 8 homicide detectives to investigate Paula's murder, and right away they began collecting information about Dean's finances and developing theories. They told reporters that they were confident they'd solve the case. According to court records dug up by detectives, ventures in which Dean Goss was involved in had 3 separate lawsuits against them, totaling somewhere around $22,000. Another suit later found he owed a company almost $10,000 for the lease of 2 walk-in freezers. At the same time, Dean Goss's Cattleman's Cove was attempting to sue the landlords of the building that housed the restaurant and club for upwards of $3.5 million. It's unclear exactly why, but those landlords obviously weren't having it and were countersuing Goss for rent and back taxes of around $47,000. Dean was embroiled in a hot legal mess. Meanwhile, investigators continued to persuade 49-year-old Dean and his 22-year-old son Craig to undergo polygraph examinations. The many interrogations detectives had performed on the two went nowhere. There were few known facts about Paula's murder. The cops only knew for certain, they said, that Paula was attacked as she entered the home late that night. Since Paula should have arrived at the Goss home when it was still light out, having left Dean at the hospital at around 5 p.m. to go there, presumably detectives uncovered evidence that she'd left and returned to the home later that evening, but such details are unknown to us. The Houston police were also certain that the attack had nothing to do with robbery, since Paula Goss still wore plenty of expensive jewelry when she was found, and her purse, too, was nearby. No signs of forced entry further strengthened that notion. By late November, 4 months after the slaying, no new leads were coming in. The brutal attack on Paula suggested her murder was an act of intense personal rage, and detectives commented that those facts alone narrow the playing field substantially. The cops said that the person that they believed was responsible for the slaying has close ties to the Goss family, but they declined to name names or even comment on their theory of a motive, or perhaps lack thereof. But it didn't matter anyway, as they couldn't put the evidence together they needed for an arrest. It's extremely likely that Houston homicide investigators closely compared the murders of Dean Goss's wives, the 1982 murder of Elaine Richmond Goss, and the 1985 murder of Paula Brawley Goss. They knew Dean wasn't involved, at least not directly, as he had solid alibis for each. Judging by comments made to reporters, authorities appeared to believe that the man was not responsible at all. That the two wives' slayings were connected was certainly something authorities believed, but it was also something they just couldn't prove.
"Same house, same family,"
Houston Police Sergeant J.C. Mosier commented.
"It's very unusual."
But that's certainly not where the similarities end. Besides the obvious, the fact that they were both wives to Dean Goss, both Elaine and Paula were fully clothed. Neither were sexually assaulted in any way, so it seems clear that the killer was not motivated by rape. Nor were they motivated by robbery. The fact that no clear motive exists is a strong similarity. Elaine and Paula were nearly the same age at the time of death. Elaine was 42 and Paula 43. Both women were shot at close range with small caliber firearms, Elaine in the back of her head with a .22 caliber, and Paula in the back of her neck with a .25. There was another striking similarity as well. one never discussed back in 1982 publicly after Elaine was murdered. She, like Paula later would, experienced many terrifying and threatening phone calls in a specific time period leading up to her death, and both women were filled with fear and paranoia as the result. After the death of Dean's second wife, Paula, friends of Elaine's came forward to the press, telling of financial records the woman had obtained not long before she was killed. Records that, according to one friend who wished to remain anonymous, would have shown that her parents had been swindled out of a substantial amount of money. Now, if this particular fact is true, it's unlikely that Elaine and Paula's caller were the same person. Either way, detectives refused to comment one way or the other about the existence of such financial records. According to Elaine's mother, Virginia, she nor Elaine's father, Henry, knew of any such theory, or, presumably, the records themselves. It must be noted here that the father and brother of Alan Berg, whose 1968 murder remains unsolved and who was the subject of our last episode, claimed that they'd received threatening calls from Frank DeMaria. Frank DeMaria was nearly put on trial for hiring Charles Void Harrelson to kill Alan Berg over business disputes, but the case was dismissed when the legendary Percy Foreman got Harrelson off. Dean Goss, as we know, had dealings with Frank DeMaria, at the very least by borrowing money from him for Elaine's funeral, but it's certainly not haphazard to guess that Dean dealt with DeMaria even before that. To be clear, we don't know for sure. If the Bergs' claims are true, it seemed DeMaria liked phone calls. These threatening calls to Paula and Elaine, anyway, are an incredible coincidence at the very least. After Paula's murder, Dean Goss opened another restaurant, but that too was short-lived. Perhaps a convenience store could work, Dean then thought, but that venture folded in no time as well, but not before Dean sunk every last dime he had into it. In February of 1986, Houston homicide investigators called a press conference concerning Paula Goss's case. They had two important developments, both of which they believed would bring new light to Paula's murder. First, detectives announced what they called a big break. They'd found the gun used to shoot Paula. Just weeks after the slaying, an unidentified individual passing by a storm drain a few blocks from the Goss home saw something. They looked closer and discovered it was a small .25 caliber automatic pistol. For whatever reason, this person did not turn over the firearm to police until January of 1986. When they did, the cops easily and quickly determined that it was Paula's gun, one she always carried in her purse for protection. She'd purchased it, in fact, not long after the threatening calls to her began. It was immediately sent out for testing, but the rusty, pitted pistol was too corroded to lift any fingerprints, and ballistics testing couldn't be performed because of the firearm's condition. However, police told the gathered reporters they were certain the gun was used to shoot Paula in the back of the neck. As the result of this discovery, a substantial reward, too, would be offered. The slain woman's brother, Scott Brawley, took the podium. Traveling all the way from Columbia, South Carolina, he came to announce that he was offering a $25,000 reward for information about his sister's death. Scott went on to say that he was offering the reward for a month tentatively, but he'd certainly consider extending the offer. He felt a month was plenty of time to come forward, and anyone who did so would have their identity protected if they so wished. $25,000 is the kind of money that someone could use, Scott went on, and if it led to his sister's killer, it would be worth every cent. Sergeant Kenny Williams told the press that the department was optimistic with the announcement of these details. They had a particular suspect in mind, he said, but they hadn't ruled anyone or anything out yet. He added that there were many theories in the investigation, and one is that Paula's killer and Elaine's killer are the same person. Though tips came in as the result of these announcements, none provided substantial leads, and the case of the murder of Paula Jane Brawley Goss was going cold. As difficult as it might be to believe, Paula's murder was not the last great tragedy in Dean Goss's life. While we're not entirely finished discussing the murders of Elaine and Paula, we've got another major event and strange lawsuits to cover on the final episode of our series, Death in Houston High Society. That's next time on Gone Cold. If you have any information about the murders of Paula Jane Brawley Goss, James Jackson Brown, or Elaine Karen Richmond Goss, please contact Houston Crime Stoppers at 713-222-8477. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as the Coed Killer, the Odessa Lust Murders, and our latest there, the Tourniquet Killer Parts 1, 2, and 3, among others. Thanks so much to everyone who supports us at Patreon. We couldn't do this without you, and we appreciate it immensely. The Houston Press, the Houston Chronicle, the Austin Statesman, KVUE.com, and court documents were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.